This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Good afternoon. I first of all want to apologize. I was going through some habit reactivity during the week. I don't want to give the impression that I don't want to be here. I find this a great honor to be able to do this with you all, and appreciate your time and listening, so thank you. I think one of the great things about Zen is it generates a curious mind, a soft heart and a curious mind. Not a nosy mind, but a curious mind. Like, what's this? And so two things came up this week, and I'm curious about them. So, Doug, if you were saying that because you weren't in full regalia, it went from a Dharma talk to a talk. So what does one wear for no talk? And the other, Dean, what's the name of this telescope they're going to be putting up?
The James Webb.
And what's it going to do?
It's going to give us information for the outer reaches of the universe, the origins.
The origins of the universe. Huh. Right after you shared this, something kicked me. The irony of it, that we may be on the verge of extinction. And here we are sending up something that would let us see the origins of the universe. And so in our last, just imagine this is what came up for me. In our last bits of consciousness, we're looking at the origins of the universe. Huh. Every time I think about this, I get emotional because in my lifetime, I never thought that we would be contemplating this. I just didn't. So I would like to start off with reading a few passages. The first one comes from The Awakening Body by Reginald Ray. And in this section, he uses left brain, right brain terminology. But he goes on to say that those are pretty much out now. Maybe left brain is still in, but right brain is because it's not accurate, for one thing. When we talk about right brain or right function, it's a lot more than just this. And as I'm reading what he's describing as right brain, there's more going on in there that I hope to get to in this talk around our central nervous system. Okay, so. He says, our left brain is typically described as housing our conscious self and our ego mind. It is often said to be characterized by the three L's. It is linear, logical, and linguistic. It is a seat of discursive thought. As such, it is a more or less disembodied, autonomous, closed system, cycling and recycling already existing information that exists in its database in the form of memories, ideations, labeling, judgments, and conceptual abstractions of all sorts. It houses the function of language, both spoken and written. As a seat of our ego consciousness, it carries out executive, managerial, and coping functions. Not surprisingly, the left brain is neurologically the most far removed from our body, and its direct perceptual experience, a fact that can be seen both experientially and anatomically. The left brain is not an originator or a source. It is a processor. It cannot feel, sense, or experience anything directly, and it is connected to the right brain only by a few neurological pathways. Our right brain, by contrast, is our physical, emotional self. It is deeply grounded in our body and is all about direct, unmediated, non-conceptual experience. It beholds things within a field of infinite silence and space, without any judgment or evaluation, without any discursive processing whatsoever. It receives experience of this moment in its totality without any boundaries or filtering. It is like a mirror that simply reflects. The neuroscientist and stroke survivor Jill Bolt Taylor explains that the right brain takes things as they are and acknowledges what is in the present. Everything is there in a collage, and the interconnections of everything are seen. Lacking conceptual reference points, the right brain has no sense of past, present, or future. This moment is experienced as timeless. And then this from Dongshan, in an exchange with Wai Yen, his teacher. Dongshan said to Yunyan, "I have some habits that are not yet eradicated." Yunyan said, "What have you been doing?" Dongshan replied, "I have not concerned myself with the Four Noble Truths." Yunyan said, "Are you joyful yet?" Dongshan said, "It would be untrue to say that I am not joyful. It is as though I have grasped a bright pearl in a pile of shit." At Dongshan, playing around with that word, it. So, the challenge has been, this week has been, I'm sure you agree, really rich. And so, you know, as I thought, what I thought I was going to be saying kept shifting throughout the week. So I hope this works for you all. And we'll be playing around in the poop a little bit. You know, I've spent time over the last few years, actually, it seems like, more with Vipassana folks than I have with Zen. And it feels like I'm coming back. And they always gave permission to play around in the poop, but they were kind of squeamish about it too. And when I read things like the Jewel Smear Samadhi, and I hear our discussions, a lot of it, you know, just feels off to me. It doesn't connect with my reality. You know, to when we say we're sitting facing the wall, watching our thoughts and you know, and being with our breath. You know, for a lot of Zazen, for me, it's pretty, it's a lot of other stuff going on. It's like sometimes I'm almost going to be blown off the cushion. And it's changed a little bit. But there are times that it's like that. And there's reason for that. And so, you know, I decided I'd call this talk with no disrespect or anything. The Song of Poop, The Door to Radical Openness. So, you know, when we're... basically, well, you know, Mike was, you know, I remember the first day of the talk, Mike would be sitting over there and he'd go, "It's reality as it is, it's reality as it is." I think that's what he was saying. It's just what it is right here. And So essentially what we're talking about, you know, is dependent origination. Causes and effect. Arising and falling away. You know, the ebb and flow of existence. Being in that. That's what we are. We are that. We came from that and we'll always be that. Because of those conditions we came to be, when those conditions are no longer, we won't be any longer. Individually and now it appears collectively. And remembering, you know, this really struck me. I was reading Joanna Macy's book on where she was lining up systems theory and dependent origination. I can't remember the title, but I highly recommend it. And she points out that, you know, when we're talking about cause and effect and systems and dependent origination, we're not talking about linear or two-way. It's all over the place. Think about it. It's in all directions. At any given point in time, up and down, back and forward, whatever. It's more than, you know, more than the left brain can imagine, because the left brain is what? Linear. And so as I was thinking about, you know, when I was reading, you know, going back over Ray's paragraphs there, you know, this is a fundamental split in us. A fundamental split in us and how our system perceives. And so, you know, it's, you know, the, you know, it's busy trying to figure things out and put a storyline to it. And we've had information from, you know, neuroscience that, you know, how limited the brain is. We just heard it again, you know, our thinking brain. And how do we, and then, but we have this other part in here too that's the dual mirror. He even describes it as such, many faceted, just taking in raw data. And so it must be overwhelming, you know, with this sense in here, it must be overwhelming to this. And yet, this is what rules. That which thinks it knows doesn't, really. One of the first things I had a couple of years ago, I was out here for a few things at 1440. Everybody familiar with that fancy place? It's over on the other side of the mountain, close to Santa Cruz. And Jack Kornfield said, you know, most of our thinking is, I'm sorry to say this, fake news. And yet, you know, it insists that it's true. We insist that we're true. We're insisting that our perception and everything is true. And I really think that this, you know, I'm going to wander around here. You know, I think about these old Chan masters sitting in the mountains. And, you know, they seem to be more aligned with it. I think there was a split. That fundamental split was there, and that's what the Buddha came to in his teaching. You know, greed, hate, and delusion, and all this other stuff. What gets in the way of being, you know, what we say our true self, you know, what gets in the way of being sort of a balanced human being? And I think over time, we human beings have become, that split is becoming really split. It's got us split off from ourselves and from what is, and we're living with the consequence of that. You know, we really pushed that jewel mirror in us down. And so the, where was I going with that? You get old, this happens. Well, so the question then becomes, how do we restore it? And to me, Buddhism has always offered that. It's always offered that wholeness. I say, Zen has saved my sorry ass. And it has. You know, my experience is that, you know, and I began wondering about this a few years ago, and Mark Epstein in one of his books said that this is true, from his perspective, that it is true that if we have poor attachment as children, you know, this practice can restore that. And I think it's true. That's been my experience. Why? Because it helps you to be okay with yourself, to come back to yourself. Come back. Psst, here I am. So to come back to the Dongshan exchange. You know, this is a thing about working with this stuff. You know, Jill, and thanks for bringing this really alive yesterday for me. You know, it was bzzz. But there are little things in there. You know, just the title, Jewel Mirror. It can set us off more than a hair's breadth. Because, you know, just our language conditioning, how we hear it. And it was interesting for me. You know, I have a small brain, so life is pretty simple. But I was sitting around here listening the last few days of this complex thinking going on. Frameworks that I don't know anything about. The frameworking. And you think, and how is that? You know, all these different perceptions. It was rich. It was a jewel mirror. That's that too. But the jewel mirror, it was here. But that's the dynamic that's also right there. Is that language? Our language and our thinking go. Just takes a little bit, and we start going this way with it. And jewel mirror sets us up for something. The jewel. In our conditioned way of thinking, our materialistic way of thinking. And so maybe the practice starts to become something else, and we stop seeing something, and we stop hearing. That came to me when I was reading this exchange. And first of all, when I first read it, I thought it was a move. And, you know, there's a similar line by Lin Chi. I think he's a contemporary of Dongshan, right? Close to it?
Yeah.
And so there's a, you know, in the Lin Chi's Man of No Rank, you know, after an exchange with a monk, he goes, "Ah, man of no rank, what a dry piece of crap he is." You know, and I thought, you know, it was one of those exchanges where, you know, you know somebody's really working with something, but don't get too attached to it, you know, or, you know, you're using this teaching and it's like the raft that gets us over there, you know, but you just don't hold to it, you don't cling to it. And at first I thought that was it. I thought that, you know, I saw that as that type of exchange. And then I thought, oh, well, he's saying, oh, yeah, you know, what do you say about there? You know, I have not concerned myself with the Four Noble Truths. But I think he's being coy with us there. I think he probably did. He probably took it in. He absorbed it. He tasted it. He chewed it. He digested it, and he pooped it out. And there was value in it. There was something he got out of it. And I was thinking, going back to Lin Chi, if we don't get something out of it, it's just a dry piece of crap. You know, taking it in. And then I thought, I'm just bouncing around the jewel mirror here a little bit. And then I thought, well, you know, there are some creatures, some birds, and they see a pile of cow dung. That's lunch. Looking for the undigested grain. No sense of whatsoever of that this is poop. It's food, source of food. So again, our perspectives and being able to, you know, take that, you know, that jewel mirror in us, you know, or allow, not take it, allow that jewel mirror to sort of just, it's freedom. It's wandering around. You know, when it happens to me, people look at me kind of strange. And I'm getting kind of used to it. But it's, you know, just allowing it to move. But like I say, there, you know, I think that the dynamics of the world, you know, the dependent arising, is overwhelming. The brain can't fully comprehend it, and yet when the brain quiets, it begins to quiet. You know, just sitting here, I can feel the hum of it, you know, in places like this. And also, but our interior wiring is, you know, we have to appreciate that the strength of the energy in our wiring, you know, it's strong, it's powerful. And so when we're sitting here, at least for some of us, maybe not for all of us, but when we're sitting here, appreciating that, appreciating the bumping up against, the pulling and pulling away of, you know, of our conditioned stuff. And, you know, there's also something, you know, that I came across earlier this summer. I went to an immersion training on polyvagal theory. And it was fascinating. And it was... you know, very simply, it's about our autonomic central nervous system. There are three aspects of it. There's a dorsal, and the first two were evolved. The evolution of it started way before there were human beings. So the dorsal is the freeze mechanism, and it came about 500 million years ago. The sympathetic, which is the fight or flight in us, came about 400 million years ago. And then there's what they call ventral vagal, and that's what we, that's that part of, that's our human quality of being able, we look in the faces and we feel that warm connection. We feel that sense of safety. And so it's, you know, when we become alive to this, we can start tracking where we are on the ladder. But, you know, when going back to what Ray was saying, that's what experiences first in us. That's the setup. And depending on whatever your setup is it fight or flight? Is it sympathetic? Is that the first registration of experience? Or is it the dorsal, the shutdown? And then beginning to notice that. So those two things, if you realize, line up really well with the five hindrances, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry. I happen to think the five hindrances, you know, it's all, you know, after attachment aversions, it's just degrees on those first two going on out, pushing away or clinging to. And so the... That dynamic coming in, that first registration, It shapes how we think. It shapes how we perceive. This is what the Buddha said. And it's distorted. The brain is the last to know. And it's running around putting its narratives on anything, on everything. And in this process, you know, the wiring is developing. You know, starting in the womb, the wiring in our neural pathways is developing. Narratives get in. The narrative's there. The narratives become really powerful and controlling. And the emotions are all wound up in the wiring. And they keep us, you know, that's that dynamic that really, you know. And I think over time, human beings, you know, that's becoming, you know, more, a stronger and stronger pattern. We're a more anxious people. We're a more afraid people. And just a little sidebar here. When I was at an insight retreat a couple of years ago, somebody in a Q&A raised their hand and said, you know what, I notice there's pain. I also notice I'm in sloth and torpor. That's me! And I realized that for a long time my zazen has been in sloth, because when there's pain, I go in sloth and torpor. My pattern is I go from reactive, I go from sympathetic into a shutdown. Okay. And I just thought I was, you know, but I was really repressed. And I think, and Deb Dana, who wrote the book Polyvagal Theory, when I was talking to her about that, she goes, yeah, almost every meditator she knows, for them, meditation is dorsal vagal, shut down. So that's just something to keep in mind. But anyway, but there is hope. Because this is why, you've heard all this, the plasticity of the brain, the plasticity of the system. And I'm going to come back to Buddhism.
Excuse me, Chuck, could you explain what you mean by the dorsal vagal shutdown?
It's a freeze mechanism.
You mean so that in meditation people are...
Huh?
So you're saying that people who meditate, they're...
Well, it becomes like, think of it more as sloth and torpor. It's sort of a shutting down against the pain, a numbing against. And it may be emotional pain, maybe physical pain. Okay. And so what I found, you know, when I came back into the Satipatthana Sutta, and I'm thinking of dependent origination, you know, the Buddha, you know, this stuff, you know, the Satipatthana, you know, it's the flow of dependent origination within the human being. He's just channeling it. You know, there are four foundations, body, and by the way, body is about 60% of the Satipatthana. Feelings, is this pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral? Mind, emotions, and then the dhammas. And the dhammas, you know, as we go into the dhammas, it's just sort of drilling down into our experience. It's just the first three going deeper and deeper. And so the Buddha, you know, for the Buddha, when he was asked, if he were to say, you know, what is just this, he would say the six sense gates and the five aggregates. And therein lies our suffering, and therein lies our release from suffering, our unhooking from suffering. And coming back to the suffering part, you know, over the years I've heard people talk about suffering. Well, it's kind of a dis-ease, it's kind of this, it's kind of this. Well, what suffering, what he's talking about, is the second arrow. You've heard the two arrows teaching? Anybody here hasn't? So the first arrow is the existential pain that we experience in life. Old age, sickness, and death. Broken leg, whatever. And the second arrow is what we add to it. Okay? And the Buddha said the second arrow hurts more. Okay? And so, you know, he helped, you know, so basically, when, you know, from, you know, I tell clients, is what's the reaction to the reaction? They go, you know, I say poop happens, but, you know, it, what's the reaction? What's the reaction to that? And generally, a lot of the reaction to it is, boy, I'm screwing up. Why am I there again? Why can't I get it right? There's this internal judgment stuff going on, you know, that just keeps us split. It's another split in us. It just keeps us split that we're not supposed to be this way. Why can't I be that way? And so, you know, and then when I'm thinking about that, you know, and I'm thinking, oh, it's, you know, dependent origination, you know, oh, it just is. It's just happening. There's nothing wrong with me, really. When causes and conditions are such, this is going to happen. When causes and conditions are changed, it's not going to be there anymore. We start looking at causes and conditions. Another little sidebar, you know, about awareness. You know, so all of this, what I'm finding out is that this is, you know, how this begins to impact awareness. And I'm still trying to figure this awareness thing out. Because it's not the left brain, it's not the right function, it doesn't seem to be. It seems to be something else that's aware. And I'm going to go out on the limb here. You know, this really sort of a confirmation of this yesterday is, for me anyway, is that, you know, where the teachings of the five ranks or the five functions or the five aspects come, you know, and these poems come from, you know, the something in there that had a sense of this split and wholeness. And how it started, you know, that movement around that. You know, awareness. You know, awareness and how we, you know, how that is. And so we bring in stuff like neuroscience and all this information. It's all really good. It's as long as we don't cling to it and say that's it. But for me, you know, it's really going into the satipatthana, spending time with it. And then, you know, just bringing stuff in and how it informs awareness. Physics, you know, how that, you know, it just does. It feeds it. Our awarenesses this week have been fed and informed and changed. That's what would keep me awake at night, is with that happening. It's what's keeping me disjointed right now. But it's it just does that. It brings it in. Causes and conditions, dependent arising. It's the vibrations, the vibrance. It's so vibrous, you know, it's alive. It's always feeding us.
Vibrous?
Well, what's the word I want?
I've heard that used.
You have, you?
So. Vibrous.
Okay, good, thank you. And so the question, you know, the question is, coming back to practice, how does this inform practice? And for me, I found a lot of liberation in the last few years through this process, and coming back to me, in a way that's okay with me. So, you know, I'm going to go through. There's anybody here heard of RAIN? Okay. So it's an acronym. You hear it in the Theravadan circles, the insight circles. Recognizing what's happening. Accepting it, allowing it. This just is. This is what's here. And usually in those first two steps, something shifts. And then you get to the stickier part, as Doug was saying, the burrs in the grass. But I talk about the spin cycle. And then the really hard stuff, you know, that keeps you awake, it keeps you spinning and stuff like that. And how do we dance with that? And so that's called investigation. And you're there with it, you know, it's not a discursive type of thing, it's just being with it. You're really alive to causes and conditions. When this is happening, you know, what's happening and what's arising. And you might say, okay, I'm in one of the five hindrances, or where am I on the ladder, in the polyvagal ladder, or just things to investigate. The Satipatthana going into Abhidharma, they got these very long lists, but just notice when you're activated. Just notice the activation, and then come to where it is in the body. Come back to the body, where it is, and just be with it and just watch it, and something will move. And then you come to the non-identification, and non-identification has been really liberating for me. It is you, but you are not it, essentially. This stuff is happening, it's not you. We identify with it, but that identifying with it, I think, perpetuates the split. We make it us, and it perpetuates the split. And there's a big opening. There's a big opening with a non-identification. And then, there's something else that the Buddha says in the Satipatthana, which is really a liberating thing. Just simply noticing when this is present and when it's not. Okay? So when you're sitting, noticing when you notice there's thinking, you might notice what the thinking is about, but you don't want to analyze it, just notice it. And when you decide, but also notice the energy of the thinking. And when you turn and come back, notice what's there then. For me, I maintain that all thinking is a perpetuation of self, a perpetuation of narrative about self. When you're in a spin cycle, you're thinking of something over and over again, you're in defense of something about you. And or some narrative about you. And so very simply, when I heard this, it's sort of when I was at an insight retreat and I heard this, is don't worry about any thinking. Don't be afraid to just come back from thinking. But don't push it away. I agree with Doug. Don't just say you're letting go of it, because that's too close to repression. Again, a splitting move, repressed stuff. Okay. And so even the poop coming through, can you just simply be with it? Not judging, becoming curious, coming back to curiosity. What is this? Stephen Batchelor talks about being in a Korean Zen monastery for a 3-month practice period, staring at a wall and just simply asking, what is this? Not expecting an answer. But what is this? Curiosity. What is this? What is this? Just watching. Being with. Noticing that when it's here, what it's like, and when it's not here, what it's like. Noticing what the energy of the breathing is, and when you come back you come back to your breath, you come back, noticing that. For me, there's a release. The body gets to feel it and know it. And it gets to be comfortable with itself. It stops being afraid of itself and judging. Okay, the hard stuff, can I lean into the hard stuff? How far can I lean in? Can I give myself permission to back away from it? Leaning in, backing away, leaning in. It's really being alive in it. And towards the end here, I'd like to touch on the concentration that we were talking about the other day. And from my sense of it, the two different types of concentrations. There's the one-pointedness. And the one-pointedness, and the Theravadins have a specific practice around this. I mean, there's the breath, there's this type of thing. But the specific practice is they stare at a colored disc for a matter of weeks or longer. And then they attain some type of non-self bliss type of thing. And the Buddha was very good at that. You know, that's what he got really good at, and he decided, but this isn't it. This ain't relieving my suffering. And then there's the concentration that I'm becoming to know. And again, it comes back to that sense, that feel, being in the body. And these times of coming, the coming back from thinking. These times of noticing what it's like when this is happening. And then what it's like when it's not happening, getting to know that. Is that accumulates the concentration and awareness begin to deepen and expand. It's a clear, open awareness. Clear, just open. And it's open to what is. It's open to what's coming through. It's open to what the ego mind is so afraid of. We begin to open up. It may be gradual, maybe slow, but it begins to open and deepen, and for longer periods of time to just be with experience as it is. That's my theory for right now. But that's my sense, and that's my experience so far. As I tell my students, I try not to spread too much poop. I try to, based on my own experience. Whatever's coming through, the heart gets open. It gets stronger. It gets open. Your heart can handle more than you think it can. To whatever's coming through. And I think that coming back to what Buddhism and Zen have to offer is to the human race, and maybe it's even at the end of time, at the end of our time anyway, is something. Maybe it offers the courage to see us through this. I'll close with just a couple of things. One is from Stephen Batchelor, and then the other is from her name is Catherine. What's her last name? It'll come to me. She's a senior insight teacher who sent around this article that's very sobering. Batchelor says, to embrace life with comprehension involves coping. It has more to do with how we get... Oh, wait a minute. Hold on. Okay, to embrace life with comprehension involves coping. It has more to do with how we get about, deal with conflicts, realize possibilities, and engage with others than with acquiring knowledge of the nature of the mind or reality. Comprehension requires the opposite of aloofness. It requires being embedded in a culture, a language, a society, not to mention a flesh and blood body that inhales, exhales, drinks and eats, pisses and shits. Oh, I meant poop. The kind of knowing entailed in parina may therefore be more akin to, he's using these Pali terms, the knowing of this is like the ways in which we know a person, a piece of music, a path, a town. It comes from living or working with someone, spending many seasons. In a landscape, or slowly gaining an appreciation of a work of art. To comprehend dukkha is to comprehend life immediately and ironically, with all of its paradoxes and quirks, its horrors and jokes, its sublimity and banality. Didn't go farther. So it's simply, just over and over, being here with this, becoming very familiar with it, open to it. And the more we're with it, we're sitting with it, we're open to it, It's just us. Just opening to what is right here, right now, in the flow. Noticing that when the left brain kicks in, when you can feel it coming in, just being with the in the flow of it, they're rising and falling away with experience. And not worried too much about what it's all about. For the last quarter century of his life, Leonard Cohen was one of my closest friends. We would often talk at the small kitchen table in his modest home in Los Angeles until the wee hours of the morning. And when I would make a move to leave, he would bring out the fine port he had been saving, or show me some of his recent drawings, or regale me with a story of his time in Cuba in the early 60s. He loved engagement, and there was no place in conversation he wouldn't go. In his company, I never censored my thoughts. Since his passing, I have realized that he was not only a close friend, but a life mentor. One of the most inspiring aspects in this regard was what one would call his heart bravery. It is, in my way of seeing, the highest form of courage. In fact, the word courage comes from the Latin cur, meaning heart. Leonard's special genius was his ability to communicate both from the sorrow and the beauty of the world, even in the same sentence. He never looked away from either, not even in his final months, when pain racked his body. He had a twinkle in one eye and a tear in the other. In these last years of his life, we had many conversations about climate chaos, as he knew I was studying the subject. He always listened intently and asked pertinent questions throughout our discussions. Although the climate had not been his own focus, his was more of a passion for politics. There was no surprise for him seeing how close we were to the edge. He understood human nature and assumed we would do in ourselves. One need only listen to his song, The Future, to know how prescient he was on the matter. And yet, we laughed over all the years, laughing like crazy. Leonard was a master of gallows humor, and I have a well-honed appreciation for that as well. The power of gallows humor, and I highly recommend it in these times, is that it allows a sideways glance at the gathering clouds while one is still sipping tea in the garden. All these small moments of recognition serve to accustom our awareness to difficult realities, to hammer at the chains that bind, to allow us to go a bit, to let go a bit. In sharing gallows humor, it is and also comforting to know that your friend sees tragicomedy as well. There is an amazing amortizing of the burden when we share a heavy load. Courage is often confused with stoicism. The stiff upper lip, bravado that masks fear. There is another kind of courage. It is the courage to live with a broken heart, to face fear and to allow vulnerability, and it is the courage to keep loving what you have even though the world is gone. In another part, she was in an exchange, and, you know, she asked him, how do I talk to people about this? And he says, just don't tell the children. So it's been a very clumsy effort today, but in terms of how we come back to ourselves, how we come back to that jewel that's in there, that is there. And, that open awareness that can be with what is as it's arising and falling, no matter what it is. Down this, this rocky path, not worrying about you, what you look like, it's you're a human being with all the stuff that human beings do. But now we have this. We have this insight. We have this practice. And we really need it now. I was talking to Chris a while back. I go, you know, this has got me thinking. As we, as practitioners, what it's up to us now. What's our role here? How do we keep it well? Starting with ourselves, starting with our humanness, and all of its aspects. How do we keep this going forward? You know, one final story, and I'm sorry to be so long, but one final story. One of the most prescient teachings I had was many years ago at City Center. And I this thing bubbled up in my head, you know, and so I went into Dokusan with Michael Winger, and I said, why do you need Buddhism to do this? And he says, you don't. You know, curious mind, right? And I said, so why do you stay with it? He goes, and that became a koan for me. And my sense is, why do I stay with it? It's gratitude for all those people before me who kept it well, and keep keeping it well, kept passing it on to us. Could you all stand up, please? I want to break things up a little bit today, coming back into the body. Randy, or Tyson, or Mark, Tyson. I'm sorry, could you come on? And if you're not comfortable in doing this, please don't.
Was that all you wanted?
No. I wanted your movements.
Oh. When I get up in the morning, Chuck saw me doing this. So I start off, and if you want advanced practice, which I don't know, you can start off with a smile.
Let's look at each other when we smile.
In the common room, you've probably seen it. I just start to move like this, just really gently, slowly. Just, there's nothing to it, but there's also no self. I think it's the interesting thing. If you can, I've gotten to that point maybe because I don't care, and so it's just like it feels so good. And then I raise my arms a little bit. A lot of these are things that you've been doing in yoga, and I'm sure you already do. And then, all the beautiful ship, and it's a moonlight night, and what I'm doing is loosening my fluids, but in a very respectful way. Just if you can, to the extent that you can really just let yourself go and imagine being a child again. You get on the floor. you have no ego to try to withhold. So, anyway.
Thank you.
Mark, I have to share with you, when I broke my hip last year,
yeah.
The hardest thing was not, you know, being able to move like I was used to being able to move. And the greatest thing was one night in the middle of the night, because I was always supposed to be using it. I start moving my head to the music. And it was like, oh my God. I mean, I was doing swimming, you know, all this rehab. But to really be able to, you know, do that. I mean, the swimming was a lot of that. Which is so great to be able to move like that again.
To embody
yeah. So maybe we can come into Q&A.
Do we have to sit down?
No.
Hey, this is sad.
Doug.
Rich. riches continue in the jewels. You talked about this dorsal action. I thought the dorsal was on the back, but I guess it's
the gut
by the heart of it.
Mm-hmm.
And you said that when pain arises, there's, I guess, like the word I'm using is retreat, or to put
it away.
And you said that what often arises is both sloth and torpor.
I likened the dorsal action to sloth and torpor.
So my question is, what do you do next?
Oh, okay. If you're in dorsal, you need that ventral. You need the sympathetic energy. You need that fight or flight energy to bring it up, to connect with dorsal. So it's a process of bringing, you know, letting that sympathetic, you know, getting some sympathetic energy going, and then bringing it up. But when from my own experience is awareness. Mm-hmm. When that woman made that statement, it was bang, awareness, and it changed for me.
So you also started off with
talking about inquiry or curiosity, and that kind of awareness, does it have curiosity in it?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. It's like, ah, what's up now? Okay, there's this. Oh, okay. And being so curiosity, you know, gentle curiosity, alive curiosity is open. Okay. And it's playful. And it's, you know, that playfulness, that for me is like, it's just like the Zen spirit.
Thank you.
Could I add one comment without the mic? It's that the story that I heard is that this freeze response is actually inherited from a turtle. So that and it's dorsal, but it essentially it's its reaction to any sudden stimuli, and it withdraws. So that's how you do the freeze. That's why you do the freeze. It's actually genetically connected to the turtle.
Well, I don't know if it's, you know, I don't know if turtle's been around for 500 million years. I don't know, but it started in the earliest life forms,
like sea anemones.
Huh?
The sea anemones, mollusks. You know, when you touch them, they they withdraw.
Yeah. So yeah, but it does go back to these. You know that it's like, you know, the left brain, the small ego brain, has its functions. It does keep us, you know, in line to a certain extent, just because it gets carried away. We need it. We need the managerial aspects of it. We need the actions of the polyvagal that I described. They keep us safe. But again, it just becomes too grooved, too ingrained in us. Please do the mic, please.
I didn't really have a comment. I just wanted to know what the reference was, your Stephen Batchelor reference. Was that from a book?
After Buddhism.
After Buddhism?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
I have a question, Ernie. I read somewhere recently that they said if you're feeling tired and zazen, to open your eyes up really wide, and that helps. Also, I had a question. I think it was Dogen said to meditate in zazen like your hair is on fire. And like, what does that mean? I assume not literally go up. What'd you say?
Ah.
Oh.
Well, you know.
I just got my.
I'll let you live into that one. Did you question?
This is a comment, which I wasn't going to say, but I thought I was terminally unique in being the only slothful, torpid person. And now I know that it's a natural state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, for me, I'm a dual. Because I go from high reactivity you go from high reactivity into dorsal, and it's, you know, and I realized that again. I had a lot of stuff come through in the middle of the night for me, but you know, I was doing this training, and now I get it. It's like it's from the response. Sit down, shut up, kid. And so if you get that enough in various versions, you might go from the sympathetic into the dorsal, you know, that type of thing. You know, it's, and you're touching on, there's so much I left out, but one of the things in one of your translations of the Jewel Heart, you know, it talked about, you know, that line, you know, the inquiring impulse, you know, potential or water rises. You know, so that is, you know, what we're cultivating is our innate potential. We're giving it room to come forward. And that's, I think that's, you know, for me, that's why Zazen, you know, is really cultivating an open space.
Open space reminds me of emptiness. Yeah. And that's cool.
But very full and vibrant.
Mm. Just following up on this, I'm curious of Doug's question and other people's question about, I really appreciate you bring. Are you okay?
You okay?
I really appreciate this. Your insights about the split nature, because that's been a big part of my investigation, and we'll have to talk more. It was really interesting. I don't know if you ever read anything by Alexander Lowen, but he...
Say that again?
Alexander Lowen, he talks about the split. So there's the shutdown, the dorsal shutdown, and then you're saying the sympathetic, like fight or flight, which makes me think of the tethered cult, and which really struck me. I thought so much of my Zazen, I definitely do the shutdown, but so much of my Zazen, especially my Sesshin Zazen over the years, is the tethered cult, you know, just like foaming at the mouth, like, you know, tied to this stake. And it pretty intense, you know, sometimes. And so then are you saying there's something outside of that polarity of either freeze, shut down, or hyperactive, fight, flight, like hypervigilance. That's the vagal?
The ventral vagal. The
ventral vagal, okay.
So there's dorsal vagal and there's ventral vagal, and they're the two ends of the vagus nerve. Okay, the two dynamics of the vagus nerve. Okay, which basically starts here, just right at the brainstem, and extends down into the body.
And do the two ends have different, is there a spectrum of states associated with that? Because I was thinking it almost maps on to there's almost a correspondence. Like rather than shut down, it's possible to be in a really calm, settled, quiescent state that is not shut down, and also it's possible to be in a really energized, enlivened, open state that's not reactive. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like a mirror, or like the other one is like a funhouse mirror, like the distortion of those states that are more open and free and liberated.
Deb would say that, you know, she thinks meditation, you know, is, you know, some state, you know, ventral dorsal, you know, is getting more open, open and alive. You know, so, but, you know, the, another thing I meant to say in there too, just I'm sorry, is, you know, is that, you know, is that concentration builds, deepens and widens, that equanimity, to be able to hold with, I want to get that word in there, hold with experience, to be with it. I tell my students you're developing a ballast of your boat on your boat.
Yeah, it's helpful.
One more question before we...
I have a comment.
Well, I like what you said earlier about curiosity, which seems to... seems to admit of uncertainty and an indeterminacy. It's like it's looking for something. So curiosity is, it's almost a, curiosity would have a, precedes a kind of judgment. It's looking for something to assess, but it's not in fact landing on something. So it's just keeping the sense of certainty at bay to some extent. Mm-hmm. The other thing I wanted to say is that I remember the first time I came across the phrase sloth and torpor. It struck me as it sounded like a law firm out of Dickens.
Yeah.
So I'll just leave it at that.
You know, I'll just leave off with on curiosity point. If I like to read Mike Eigen, he's an analyst out of New York, EIGN, and he describes being with his son. And you know, when his son was little, and just imagining what the world was like from, and watching his son go from this, going from that, you know. And that's what Zazen can be like. I'm going from this, going to that. Oh, okay. You know, just being alive.
And to keep questioning. I think it's important to question the things that you might be most certain of, just to make sure you're not sliding into
my response to me
certainty.
My response to that in me is thanks, but no thanks. I'm not buying any today. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.